Welcome to Ask AI, the podcast that brings you insightful interviews and news from the world of Canadian artificial intelligence. This episode is sponsored by Microsoft Canada. Microsoft is committed to building trusted and responsible AI systems. To learn more, go to microsoft.com/AI and check out their free AI business school to start building intelligence into your solutions today. We're also sponsored by Cinci, the global leader in data fabric technology. Visit cinci.com to learn how to eliminate integration and turbocharge your AI transformation.
Hi, everyone. This is Jackson Kahn. Welcome to the next episode of the Ask AI podcast. If you're tuning in for the first time, you should know that we want to hear your questions about artificial intelligence. This podcast is about interactivity, so we'll do our best to get expert replies to your questions and feature them on future episodes or in our newsletter. And this is also an opportunity to share news about your upcoming projects and activities in the artificial intelligence sector. Just send an email with your question or your announcement to info@askai.org. You should also know that this week, our friends at the Toronto Machine Learning Society have provided our listeners with a promo code to their annual conference and expo. This is one of Canada's premier AI gatherings and will feature over 60 speakers and 15 different workshops, as well as 6 different tracks. The online event is taking place November 16th to the 19th. And if you're a listener, you can head right over to torontomachinelearning.com and use promo code ASKAI to receive $15 off your ticket purchase. It's worth checking out. For today's episode, we are so glad to be joined by one of the preeminent minds in artificial intelligence in Canada and in our city and in the world. Her name is Fotina Agrafiotti. She is the Chief Science Officer at RBC, as well as the head of their artificial intelligence lab, Borealis AI. She's responsible for RBC's intellectual property portfolio in the fields of artificial intelligence and machine learning. She also serves as the co-chair of the federal government's Advisory Council on Artificial Intelligence. Previously to these roles, she served as the Chief Technology Officer at NIMI, a biometric security company and the maker of the NIMI wristband. Fotina completed her doctorate in electrical computer engineering at the University of Toronto, and she was named one of Canada's top 40 under 40 in 2017. Fotina, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Hello, my pleasure to be here.
Starting off with the basics, I'm wondering about, you've had such a sort of illustrious path and so many cool roles, but I'm wondering about, you know, what was your path into artificial intelligence? How did you get engaged in this field? Was that something that you started at university, or how did that go?
Yes, my first steps into machine learning really date back to my research as a master's student, I would say, at the University of Toronto. I had moved to Canada around that time in order to pursue graduate studies. I had been introduced to machine learning briefly during my undergrad in Greece, but I hadn't really played with it or had applied it that much until I came to Toronto and I joined a lab where we would be working on human biometric authentication. So the group there was looking at technologies that could be used to identify or verify identity using modalities that exist on the human body. So face recognition, iris, palm recognition were amongst the topics that the group was researching. And it may not sound like a machine learning space, but it is a profound application environment for machine learning technologies. So when I started there, I wanted to work on a type of research that would be a little different from traditional biometric systems. Although at the time, I guess consumer electronics didn't really have yet face recognition or fingerprint recognition, but the science behind all of that was quite advanced already. I wanted to experiment with new biometric modality. And while I was searching for that, I came across this possibility that the human electrocardiogram, your heartbeat, would be unique enough to be able to authenticate your identity, that it's so different from other people's heartbeats that it can actually separate and identify you. I was very curious about this, especially because I had seen some of that in Hollywood movies. And so I went right into it, and I started building a database of heartbeat signals from my colleagues at the University of Toronto and started using machine learning techniques to analyze those signals and see if there were unique patterns for every person. it turns out that if you just visually inspect these signals, like doctors do, cardiologists, when they look at your heartbeat on a piece of paper, they all more or less look the same. And the way I fell in love with machine learning was that we were able to apply those techniques to take something that was seemingly very similar as a pattern and go really deep into that, transform it in a way that allowed us to find very unique properties for every individual. That was my first step in applying machine learning systems. And since then, I've been a really big fan of these technologies.
And that's really, really remarkable work. I wish we had time to get into absolutely everything you just talked about as well. I'm particularly fascinated that even at that point, from the data side, I was wondering how you're able to access all that health information. Or is that just, you said, with your colleagues at the university about the heartbeat signals?
Yes. So essentially what we needed in order to get started on this work was a set of recordings from healthy individuals that we would monitor over a long period of time to see whether that waveform changes. A lot of the databases that were publicly available for research in cardiology are primarily comprised of signals that have one cardiac condition or another, because most people would be looking to them to build cardiac diagnostic systems. I had to create a healthy, if you may, ECG database from scratch. And that was a major undertaking at the University of Toronto. So with the support with the Research Ethics Review Boards and my colleagues there, we recorded, I think, over 1,000 ECG recordings in a period of 2 to 3 years from students at the university.
So interesting. For me personally, my grandfather actually passed away a couple of years ago, and he was a cardiologist and an author. So oftentimes I would catch him sitting outside. He'd have his little tablet in front of him, and I'd say, "Grandpa, what are you doing? Papa, what are you doing?" And he'd say, "I'm looking at ECGs." So I grew up kind of seeing those from time to time. So very interesting that that was your path into artificial intelligence and machine learning more broadly, examining those types of things.
It's a very fascinating space. And it is because of cardiologists that we eventually got to prove that there are unique patterns in these signals. Like, cardiologists told engineers that these signals sometimes look different from one person to the next. Mm-hmm. Very slight variance, but they look different. And that's a problem for the medical sector, because when you try to establish what an anomaly is, you want everything to conform to the same pattern except for that anomaly. But if every person looks a little different, then how do you deal with that? Is that you, or is that a condition that you have developed? And they were asking these questions in many articles in the American Cardiologist, one of the major publications in that space. So when we looked at that, we thought, oh, that's a fantastic opportunity to see if it's actually different enough to identify you, rather than just trying to correct that difference in order for a diagnostic algorithm to work consistently across different people.
What ended up being the outcome, if I might ask, of that initial research?
So we were able to prove that there are unique properties within ECG that are permanent over long periods of time. Mm-hmm. And really that's what led to the creation of my first company, NIMI. We wanted to commercialize that research and built it into a product that would bring this to market through a wearable device. We were able to achieve rates that made us very comfortable around the level of security that we would be offering through a product like that.
That's really remarkable. And with NIMI, would you say that was kind of your first commercial opportunity in sort of building a product that had AI applications involved?
Oh yeah, that was the first step I ever took outside academia into anything that is business or product related. And it was by far one of the most rewarding experiences I've ever had in my life. Startups are an incredible place for you to explore your interests, your strengths, because you get to try so many different things, wear so many hats. There's enormous expectation and pressure at the same time, and things move really fast. And since then, I think I've never turned back to academia. When I saw research turning into a product for the first time and people use it, it was magic. And that's what I wanted to do ever since.
That is so cool. And I know that you're still helping other people do the same. I think, if I recall, you're on the Creative Destruction Lab board as well, which perhaps you can tell our listeners a bit about it. But my understanding is that a lot of that is helping take lab or research work and commercialize it, right?
Yes, exactly. I first came across the Creative Destruction Lab because we applied to participate in the program with my first company. And it was, I think, the first year of operation at that time. It was a very small group of people at Rotman that were running this program. And it's fascinating to see how much it has evolved ever since. And I'm very honored to be sitting on that advisory board and look at the expansion that they've had internationally as well. I think we've created a brand here in Canada through CDL that's now truly impacting and the world and enabling entrepreneurs all around the world. It was a lot of work, I know, for everyone that's been involved in that. And they've definitely built something of real value there.
That's so, so interesting. And just before we jump into sort of your broader work with Borealis, I was wondering about the AI Advisory Council with the federal government that you're involved in as well. What sort of work does that group do?
So the purpose of this group was to advise the government on a number of topics that pertain to machine learning in Canada, starting from commercialization and how to accelerate and better tap into the opportunity of machine learning for Canadian businesses, small, medium, large. It really touches a broad range. It also focuses its work on ethical applications of machine learning, and we're looking for ways that Canada can lead in developing more responsible approaches to applying machine learning technologies. And we're also looking at sustaining the advantage that we have as a scientific center here in Canada, and through continued education and funding for the local institutes to essentially not take for, how do we not take for granted that science will continue to come out from our universities after we've achieved this the first time? And how do we ensure that that's an ongoing success for our country?
I think that's such important work, especially right now where Canada's going through one of the most difficult economic times in our modern history in particular. So really respect, admire that work. Do you feel like, just given the time that we're in, that how can we double down on this work? Or is that something that has changed the context and nature of it given this period around the coronavirus?
It has not stopped being a priority for all those involved. Mm-hmm. If anything, we were able to pause and look at what's been happening in the world around us as perhaps an opportunity to look at how AI could be used to support either recovery, but also in many cases, it's been a profound testing ground for AI's ability to sustain performance through very critical times when conditions are changing so rapidly. So it's been very relevant what's been happening to the world for the field of AI.
Incredible. And now I want to get into the big piece. I'm wondering if we can start from the bottom with Borealis, and if you're able to introduce what is Borealis, how many people are working with you, what are the biggest projects you're working on? I'd love to share with our listeners all about Borealis.
Borealis AI is the R&D center for the Royal Bank. It's an institute that's operationally independent, but it focuses on building technologies for financial services that use top machine learning science, and we apply this in RBC products. I guess the story of our institute goes back in 2016, which is when we started this. The premise behind Borealis AI was that we came together because we wanted to create an environment where people would pursue fundamental and applied machine learning science and have an opportunity to commercialize it through a Canadian company. It was very, very important to us at the time, and it continues to be today, but I guess it was top of mind in 2016, what was happening in Canada and the AI space, as you know, Jackson, as well. We had a lot of great research that was coming out of our universities, and some of the world's top scientists were graduating from our PhD and master's programs across the country. But when we were looking at that talent and what they were pursuing after their graduation, it was devastating. We would notice that the vast majority of the experts in this space would finish up their degrees here and then move south of the border or cross the Atlantic and take on jobs with the big tech primarily that were very interesting to them because they were offering environments where scientists would thrive. They would go in and pursue science, continue their research, and then build it into products. And when we looked at each other at the time, we felt that we had a responsibility to create the same quality jobs here back at home. We wanted to give people a good reason to want to stay back and commercialize their work through a Canadian effort and create value for Canadians, the people that had funded that science and sustained its development for decades before it was proven and before it made its way into commercial products. So that's how we started. Our vision is to be a world-class center for machine learning research and establish RBC as a leader in financial services in AI. It's a very interesting place to be because there's an element of independence and a lot of flexibility in the way we work. We do work a lot like a startup, and there's a shared responsibility that we all have at Borealis AI, that our role here is to prove that this Canadian science can create value for Canadians. Like, this is why we get to work every day. And then we built these products, and we have one client essentially to that as a startup, which is RBC. So we partner with RBC in order to integrate and launch them through our services and our products in the bank. The institute is about 120 people today, and we have labs. We have 4 centers across the country. We were very serious about ensuring that these opportunities are created equally, coast to coast, that this was not yet another opportunity for Ontario only, because looking beyond Ontario in technology, there was incredible science that was coming out of UBC, SFU, University of Montreal, University of Alberta, Waterloo. And we really wanted to be on the ground where this work was happening and create jobs there that would be meaningful for those who were graduating from the schools to join and commercialize their work here. Today, most of the people that would work at Borealis, they come from Canadian academia or startups. We have a very large engineering team as well that's tasked with taking that science and building it into products. And we work hand in hand with the bank. We're blessed to have some of the best practitioners of the banking craft available to us to teach us how financial services work, but then also the opportunity to launch this science through RBC's products that touch millions of lives in Canada. And we take that extremely seriously as well.
Well, I just wanted to comment on everything you just said. There's so many different points there. Number one is, I think it's remarkable that you are creating a venue, an opportunity to keep our best talent here in Canada and empower them. I think that's really, really remarkable. I think it's incredibly important. Have heard about the economic impacts of brain drain for a long time, but I think particularly in this context around AI, it seems like we finally decided enough is enough. So I really respect that. One of the things I wanted to ask you a bit more about is a bit more about the relationship with RBC. You mentioned sort of working hand in hand, and I know that you effectively have a dual role where you're the head of Borealis as well as the chief scientist at RBC. Is Borealis, what is ultimately the focus there? Is it tied quite closely to the commercial objectives of the bank? Is it more of an open research forum and opportunities then get commercialized? And if there are clear collaboration opportunities that those sync up with the bank? Or what's sort of the process around that collaboration?
We are part of the bank. We are all employees of RBC. Mm-hmm. And there's a number of things that we do. So we will always start from a business problem. We approach that with curiosity. We try to examine how state-of-the-art tools or science can be applied to solve it. The problems that we end up taking on at Borealis are usually the ones where there is a lot of science risk. So you have something that you're trying to solve for, but it's not clear yet how existing science can address that need. So you have to go back to research. Solve that first and then come back and apply it in order to solve that business problem. So there's a very core element to it that comes from R&D and then it's applied in the bank. And the reason why we're so focused on applying this and creating this opportunity for RBC's clients is because we feel like we've had enough of just science in Canada. Our people are not interested in just publishing papers or pushing the boundaries of science. All that is fantastic. And we do that, but we know that value is created when all of that is built into products that move society forward. And so we don't lose sight of the fact that we're here to build products and services that launch through RBC. And that is the relationship we have. We're essentially an R&D center for the bank, but we operate independently.
Mm-hmm.
We publish the research that we do. We feel that it's our responsibility to be sharing back with the community the advancements that we make internally at RBC, not just to move forward, I guess, the understanding of the AI space, but practically they can be used to solve very specific problems in other domains. Whether you have an algorithm that's detecting fraud in credit card transactions or an algorithm that's perhaps detecting a tumor in an MRI image, you are looking for a very specific pattern. And any learnings from the advancement of one domain apply to the other. It's extremely transferable. We feel that it was also our responsibility that if we are advancing something on our side, that is also shared back, that can be used to solve other problems in the world.
That makes sense. And I guess what I'm interested in right now is, so what are those key areas of focus? I did see the news that you had launched the Respect AI Hub. I was wondering, maybe, yeah, a bit more about your areas of focus and maybe that in particular.
Yes. Building AI responsibly is something that is very important to us in this specific industry. A lot of people will say that. A lot of people are talking about ethical AI today, but very few companies materially invest in doing this. And the challenge is that it's quite expensive to be pausing and stopping innovation from advancing very quickly when you recognize that you are taking risks with some of the technologies that you build. Part of the reason why I personally enjoy working at RBC is that I'm part of a business which is not really experimenting its value proposition with the clients. We've operated on clients' trust for decades. And coming into this with a new technology, there was never really ever a serious conversation about us. Are we going to compromise that trust because we want to do this cool innovation? Or are we going to stick to our old business? The answer has always been, we're going to stick to the way we've always done things, which is bring innovation to clients in a measured, in a responsible way that respects their integrity, their privacy, and of course, doesn't compromise their relationship with us. Another reason why we're so invested in this is because we are in a very regulated industry. Even if financial services institution wanted to take any such risks, and most FIs that I am aware of in Canada wouldn't, that's not how they function, we're still not allowed to. So we have to ensure that our systems are robust, that they are safe to use, that eliminate bias, and they're transparent. And so if you start like this and you want to build state-of-the-art machine learning, you immediately face the challenge of, okay, well, it is our problem to solve for these issues, or none of the research that we do at Borealis AI would ever go to market. We would never launch it in our products. Over the years, we've developed very strict practices around how we do this. And we felt recently that it was important that since we've invested so much in this space, that we share the learnings that we've had from the years that we've been doing this with the broader community, and in the hopes that that would be a first step for a shared understanding on the fact that AI can be built responsibly, and there are specific tools that can be used to do that. And there's really no excuse for not doing that either. So our Respect AI program focuses on five areas: robustness, fairness, model governance, explainability, and data privacy. And as part of that, we have released our research code, the code that we use ourselves internally when we perform our own research in this space. We've released our tutorials, our publications. Everything around how we build this internally at Borealis has been made publicly available. And we've also invited other experts in the industry to participate in this program as well and share how they are approaching this. We don't feel by any means that we have the golden solution to this problem. It's an ongoing science and it's evolving fast. But we do have a know-how thanks to the decades that RBC has been governing models and the fact that we do cutting-edge AI here. And so we felt like we need to be sharing this. And let me give you an example of how we built this into our products.
Please, yeah.
One of the key areas of research since the inception of Borealis has been in the space of reinforcement learning. This science has always fascinated us. Back in 2016, where we were first starting doing research in RL, we had the opportunity to sit down with traders from our capital markets business at RBC. They started talking to us about trading and the stock market and how it works and how their systems make buy-sell decisions every day. And there were light bulbs that were going around in the room. Like you could see scientists getting so excited because the moment someone explains the problem of trading to you, if you know ML, you immediately notice that it formulates itself as a reinforcement learning problem. You take sequential actions in a live, complex environment. Every action you take changes that environment and it impacts that. And so the following action that you take has to adjust itself based on what happened, what you did before and what happened in the environment. So that's what trading is as well. And so it was a very, very inspiring opportunity for us to check whether reinforcement learning would be applicable to model complex market conditions and analyze those and have an agent that can essentially make autonomous buy-sell decisions. The problem at the time was that this was, back in 2016, this was the first time that the value of reinforcement learning was being proven outside textbooks in academia and primarily into games. We were watching in awe, of course, like everyone else, the advancements that were coming out from AlphaGo and the team at DeepMind and Google, who were demonstrating that, hey, RL can be used to model games. And that's interesting. And so here we are at Borealis AI looking at all this and now wondering, okay, gaming is one environment and there is one strategy that works against you, that's your opponent. But can this work as a stock market when you have a chaotic environment with a lot of strategies working against each other and you at any given time? And that's what I mean about finding these opportunities to apply pure science to solve for a very, very compelling business need. And what we did over the period of the last 4 years was we've doubled down on testing and iterating, pushing really the boundaries of what reinforcement learning can do. All the way to last week, we've announced publicly the launch of Aiden, RBC's first AI trading product that uses reinforcement learning successfully. And so we went from, in one step in our business, from using a rules-based system all the way to using reinforcement learning, which was one of the most unproven types of AI at the time. And we're very proud to be offering this to our clients today. And we're also very proud because this is Canadian science that was finally proving its value through a Canadian product. It's a major scientific achievement and we're standing behind it. It makes us proud every single day. Going back to your question about the pandemic and how that impacted AI, when the pandemic hit, we've noticed enormous market volatility in the live markets. I mean, the stock prices were going crazy for a period of time. It was an important testing ground for Aiden. A reinforcement learning agent should be able to adapt automatically to changing market conditions. It should be able to, according to the theory, but we had to see it in practice. And so here we are watching that thing trade and still be able to make smart decisions in an environment that he has never seen before. It was just fascinating to watch. And by the end of it, it was able to maintain its performance for our clients and led us to launching it today more broadly for all of RBC's clients to be able to use. Not only did we do this, we spent the last 4 years not only building this algorithm for trading, which was a lot of work to do, But we also set a goal from the beginning. We said, if RBC were to ever launch an algorithm like this for its clients, it will have to be able to build trust with the clients. So it's not enough to just go in and trade on our clients' behalf and deliver the performance they expect. We also have to explain why it's making the decisions it is making. And we all know that explainability is a very challenging aspect of artificial intelligence. And so we doubled down on the problem of we got to solve for explainability. And so we had two research streams within the Institute. One was solving for RL in a complex market, and the other one was solving for explainability of that first RL in the live market. If that second one didn't work, we just wouldn't launch. It's just not the way we would ever entertain doing business with our clients. And that's what I mean. It is expensive to be thinking about how do I build this right? How do I support it in a way that builds, that it's trustworthy for society to use it?
This is one of the things I was wondering about, Fatima. I mean, congratulations to you and the team on such an incredible launch with Aiden. I think I saw in social media that the platform got a lot of attention and a lot of coverage. And I think it's because it's a monumental achievement. And I'm also personally very glad that it's coming out of Canada. But, you know, as you can see in society, a lot of people are asking questions about these algorithms and about how trustworthy they are. And I think there's some stat out there that was coming recently. It might have even actually been a survey that you folks put out, but it was almost 100, or it was over 90% of organizations have concerns in dealing with the ethical challenges of artificial intelligence. And so, yeah, I guess just an open question is whether it was this recent development with Aiden or more broadly some of the work you're doing, how are you asking those questions about how is this ethical? How are you building that or baking that into the model from the start? And I guess maybe if there's any intersection there with the open source community or whatever it may be, I'd just be interested to see how you're planning the ethical components and validating them.
So this was indeed one of our own research that was published. What we did was we surveyed over 600 businesses and we asked them some key questions about how they feel about ethical AI and whether that is a concern. We wanted to understand how businesses at different sizes and levels are thinking about these issues. The results were astonishing. We learned that I think 93% of these businesses experience barriers in building AI ethically and responsibly. So that was part of the motivation behind the launching the Respect AI program from RBC and Borealis AI. The tools, the know-how for how to approach these exist. Innovation around that space is not going to stop. Like, we do know that companies will move forward. What we wanted to ensure is that what we know about building AI ethically, the way we did it, for instance, in Aiden, when we built our own explainable algorithms around that product, that all of that knowledge is shared with that community and it's shared with the businesses. So the program has resources that both technologists as well as business leaders can tap into, and they're ready to use. I sincerely think that it can help everyone understand where the risks may lie and what are some of the good practices for how to manage those risks as we bring this to life.
I think that's a critical look into that side of the equation. I'm also wondering more broadly on the privacy concerns as well. How have you been approaching that? What are the options that you sort of offer or the strategy that you use for your researchers, for your developers on the AI side?
So we adopt an approach that's called privacy by design, which pertains to building privacy as a default setting into engineering designs. And it's also a matter of good and solid governance, right? So it's a lot of the time, companies don't know that they're leaking information until it's too late. And having many layers of governing these products before they are released is also extremely important, in addition to building them in a private way from the get-go. Both of these aspects are super, super critical.
Great. And I know that sort of beyond the privacy design, I think I read or had down in my questions around the use of manufactured data and private synthetic data generation. Is that something that is engaged at in Borealis, or is that something you're employing?
That's part of the toolboxes that we have released for researchers to use. Mm-hmm. What it pertains to is a lot of the time we have this dilemma, especially in science, and academia has this a lot too. where there are legitimate reasons why scientists need to get access to some sensitive data in order to test systems, build AIs that can solve for some of the key problems that society has, whether that is in the healthcare space, transportation, financial services as well. But sharing that data is usually difficult. And it's difficult because they're governed by, well, privacy laws and the contract that each company has with society around how they use the data that is being collected through their services. Part of that solution is technological as well. So we have toolboxes that researchers can use in order to look at private data that have sensitive information that perhaps cannot be used directly, but you can create from that a new data set that follows the same qualities, the same distribution as the original data set, but it doesn't have sensitive information in it. And that new data set can be used to do the exact same analysis and advanced machine learning, solve from the problems you're trying to solve for without actually needing to compromise privacy for the original contributors of that data set.
Super, super remarkable. I love kind of hearing about the number of different layers of the approach that you take more broadly with the team. I know we're running up on time, so just want to ask a couple last questions. One is, beyond the work you're doing day to day, are there any areas of artificial intelligence and machine learning research that are really exciting you?
Obviously, yes.
Do you have any ones in particular in mind?
And I wish I could have 5 different jobs in this world so I can just tap into and play with problems in all these different spaces. I mean, if I were to just pick one, by far, like any other person out there, what I'm mostly hopeful for is that we will use some of these advances in machine learning in the healthcare space, mm-hmm. especially around early diagnosis. I'm particularly personally very interested in the space of radiology and how we can eliminate what's measured to be today a 20% error that radiologists, human radiologists, bring to when they're diagnosing from an image. 20% of images are misdiagnosed, which means that there's something there that was not picked up or there was a wrong label that was assigned to something that was picked up in an image. That's just way too big for the stakes that of this space.
That's a huge margin of error.
Exactly.
That's exactly. Crazy. Wow. I definitely am hopeful for that as well. I'm also hopeful in the near future as well, some of the applications around alleviating this current crisis of whether it's, I've heard sort of work around automated contact tracing, faster identification of coronavirus, COVID-19. I mean, whatever may come, a lot of interesting work and applications on the pandemic side of things too. So, which is very closely related to diagnostics. So I would agree with you on that one. Very, very important. Last one I wanted to ask you about quickly. I know that you also work with Tech Girls Canada. Did you have any quick highlights to share on that?
Yeah. I've worked with the founder of Tech Girls Canada for many, many years, and I'm honored to be participating in this effort. What had started as an initiative to support women in technology, starting here in Canada and then more broadly, has now focused more and more into an area that is even hitting closer home for me, which is supporting immigrant women as they're coming in our country. There's research that is demonstrating that women with background in STEM that immigrate to Canada face a lot more challenges than their male counterparts in kickstarting their lives here. The work that Tech Girls Canada is doing is looking at documenting these cases and highlighting this problem and proposing solutions. I can assure you it's an extremely difficult thing to be a woman in such a male-dominated space. It's even harder when you have an accent or when you look different or when you don't understand this society and you first land into this new place that you're trying to make home of. And advancing your career is an afterthought. First is survival. And that's part of the reason why I'm so passionate about what Tech Girls Canada is doing in that space.
Well, I think that's a pretty incredible and important salient note to end on. Definitely respect the work of Tech Girls Canada and Sadia and so many people who are supportive of that initiative more broadly. We have so much more work to do. And I know as well, just in this pandemic and crisis as well, it has affected a lot of working age women who maybe sort of in the, even at the prime of their career, and it's holding them back. And I don't think we can stand for it as a society. We absolutely have to do more. So I'm hopeful for it. I'm very grateful that we have champions like you and people who are great role models and also working at the very frontiers of this important work. So thank you, Fotini. And I'm excited to ally and support where I can. Thank you so much for your time today on this podcast as well. I can't believe how much we went through in just about half an hour plus.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much. And also thank you again to our sponsors, Microsoft Canada and to Cinchi. For all our listeners on the line, please remember to send us your questions, your feedback, or any community news that we should raise to our email, info@askai.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at askai.org or find us on LinkedIn. Thank you so much again, Fotini, and looking forward to following all of your amazing work. Thank you.
Thanks. Have a lovely day, Jackson.
Thanks for listening to the Ask AI podcast. The executive producer was Chris McLellan. Additional production support was provided by Olina Mack and Kristen Riddell. To learn more about our webinar and chatbot projects and get information about sponsorships and volunteering, please visit our website at askai.org or email info@askai.org. Listeners can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Just search Ask AI.